And good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. Welcome, welcome, welcome to your Sunday morning session, your early morning Sunday morning session, specifically that of being my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station, Ufikile FM. And, well, things have started off pretty uncertain this particular Sunday morning, dear listeners. If you've not heard as yet, it seems like the United States has decided to step in between that little tennis match of a conflict between Iran and Israel. And it is being reported by international outlets that the Americans have bombed three particular nuclear sites. We don't know if it's nuclear weapon sites, it's just nuclear sites or potentially nuclear manufacturing sites of the Iranians in Iran. And that obviously having happened in the earlier morning hours of this morning. So just in terms of the potential of how close we are to another particular conflict on this planet, not that the other conflicts have meant anything in terms of providing any value addition to the rest of the world's particular peace and peaceful coexistence with each other. It seems that Donald Trump does not want to achieve the same particular level in this regard, specifically with the Iranians. Starting off that particular section. That particular aspect, we are finding ourselves in uncertain terms or in uncertain times, should I rather say. Now, here on my Sunday morning take, dear listeners, we do look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between in order to understand how the rest of the world or, the greater part of the world actually operates around us. And one such particular aspect in our discussion for this morning is actually based upon a perspective of looking at a unique dimension that seems to be only something that is prone to the United States as well. Now it is a little bit of, it does have a little bit of a negative, dimension to it because it is based upon the aspect of American leaders or American presidents that ultimately had fallen foul to one or two, citizens in their regard in their country that don't agree with their particular sort of like policies or perspectives in terms of what should be a priority in an American, scenario. Now, the particular event is based upon the unique component of American presidents that were assassinated. Now, the downside is it's not just our subject matter is not just purely about that aspect, even though it is, but we're looking at the why it came about as well as also the who committed the particular act as well. Reason being that on this day, on yesterday, 21 March, the gentleman, the suspect or the perpetrator, who attacked the U.S. President Ronald Reagan in 1981, at the end of that year of 1981, he was found not guilty on a aspect of insanity. The court found him not guilty on this regard. And the particular dimension that obviously stems from this is that it obviously went through a particular court process. If you would like to understand what actually happened there, and that this particular court process also, came through in terms of highlighting that the man probably is insane. Now, that is obviously based upon how psychologists and psychiatrists step in and then ultimately prove that particular dimension, in order for the court case to continue or to go forward and the likes. But we're not there to look at the aspects in terms of how you can get off free. No, that number is completely different from from the rest of the part of the world. We're looking at the unique notion that the United States only owns up to this particular negative piece of history that exists. And it's not the first time. Ronald Reagan is not the first particular president that has ultimately been impacted by this particular fate that the United States has and still owns. Because up until it was last year, when the attempt on Donald Trump's life, but he wasn't a U.S. president yet. He was a former and a competing campaign, presidential candidate. Now, the interesting scenario, the interesting dimension that we start off from is obviously we have to start from the Ronald Reagan perspective, because the suspect or the perpetrator back then was known as a gentleman by the name of John Hinckley Jr. In terms of that, Hinckley Jr. was specifically someone that walked up to Reagan. I'd actually forgotten about this particular, if I can call it like weird history, that Reagan also was attacked. Reagan is obviously touted as being the American president that brought through neoliberal economics, alongside his counterpart from the United Kingdom, that being Margaret Thatcher. They believed that they needed to walk away from manufacturing jobs, which are obviously the particular, not just manufacturing, but it was predominantly jobs that were based upon, or that were available for many people in the working class of both countries. Margaret Thatcher, obviously, when we had that particular discussion here on my Sunday morning take back in March, April, regarding the dimension of Thatcherism and what Thatcherism actually speaks to and what it actually highlights. It was in that particular scenario also that you could get a glimpse in terms of, you know, what these policies were trying to impact on the everyday lives of the UK citizens back then in the 80s. And one of the most impactful things was walking away from coal mining and mining complexes in the United Kingdom. Now, if you don't know what that actually translates to, it is an aspect also of industrialization, where you try to move forward with certain times. It's something that happened in the 1800s when the first industrial revolution came about. It was about when the factory came about, they needed people to work in the factories. And one of the dimensions was move people away from agrarian or agricultural lifestyles and move them into the urban areas and thus let them work in these factory complexes. So that's when the steam engine was invented. That was when the locomotive was invented. That was when all other kinds of technologies came about in terms of processing. And that's also how you saw the correlating spike in, if we can call it colonialism, actually also went ballistic. And when I say went ballistic, it went full frontal, all engines running, all systems go. And you started seeing resources being extracted from other parts of the world and shipped to the United Kingdom. Because at that stage, the United Kingdom was the most industrialized country. And that's just before 1900. We obviously sit with a completely different scenario, probably 100 years later after that statement that I just made, with the particular event, obviously, that came through against Ronald Reagan. Now, I have to start off from this particular dimension, dear listeners, because on this day specifically June, but actually 21 June, the scenario has been that John Hinckley Jr. was let off specifically from the charge. Well, firstly, he was caught with the gun on the site. It was one of the, probably one of the most publicized events, even after what happened to, John F. Kennedy. The same particular event also was very highly publicized, and obviously Ronald Reagan survived. Now, we obviously see that in the dimensions that obviously took place in that realm, because you only hear about Ronald Reagan's particular engagements with the Soviet, his Soviet counterparts, or even with his Chinese counterparts in the 80s. Because remember, it was Richard Nixon for the first time that visit, was the first American president ever to visit China. And that obviously, and that obviously was in the 70s. And then in 1979, China is allowed to, you know, to participate in further other particular discussions globally that impacts the world at a larger scale. Now, from the particular dimension that we're obviously looking at for this morning, we're going to be looking at all the American presidents that were impacted by this particular event known as assassinations on presidents. We're going to look at the particular perpetrators, because these individuals were caught and they were tried, or so in some cases they were executed as well. And the uniqueness specifically as to why each particular event occurred. What was the catalyst? What was sort of like the ticking time bomb, if we can say that, in this, in each particular US president's particular discussion? Now remember, you can't actually factor Donald Trump's attempt last year on his life into this discussion, because he was a former president and he was a running candidate for presidency that started from this year. He subsequently, he obviously subsequently won the elections again last year, you know, in November as well. He was obviously inaugurated this year. On 20 January this year. And he's obviously now in his, you know, it's more than 100 days time frame of his second presidency in the US. Where we actually find ourselves in this discussion is one that is pretty unique in terms of what it tries to achieve. Not the discussion, but actually the messaging that comes through from the various notions of this particular assassination attempt. But before we actually continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short list. We're going to take a short musical break and come back right after that. Coming back there from the sounds of New Guinea with the song Tinete from the album Bar Mediterraneo. They're obviously Italian, you know, electronics group, but that was the specific track there, Tinete. And that obviously brings us up like 25 minutes to the top of the hour at 6 a.m. You're listening to my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station, that is Eagle FM. And where we left off just before the musical break was getting into the notions and the terms of the particular events that obviously, you know, depict the negative. That the only, I only think it's the Americans that probably own this up to this particular historical occasion or this historical event, because it has happened so many times in their country. Now, the particular event that obviously speaks of today is that John Hinckley Jr. was ruled to be innocent by reason of insanity in the shooting of the US President Ronald Reagan. Now, in the first days of Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1981, a deranged drifter, this is now according to what the literature, you know, highlights, a deranged drifter, because they obviously link the deranged state of mind or state of being to the proven insanity scenario that obviously took place during the court process after the shooting of the US president. John Hinckley Jr. fired 6 shots from a .22 caliber revolver at Reagan as he left a Washington DC hotel. Now, one of the bullets entered Reagan's chest, punctured a lung, and lodged about one inch, which is about 2.5 centimeters away from his heart. Now, this was another critically wounded person. Was also cited at this particular event was the press secretary for Reagan, James Brady. And this obviously was a discussion that saw for the first time in modern day history, this kind of an event actually kick off. Now, the particular notion that obviously stems from this discussion is that Reagan was actually, you know, rushed off immediately to a hospital, which is an obvious particular, you know, emergency response. And then Reagan was, you know, he even joked with the doctors as he was being wheeled into the operating room, where he said, and he was still chatty from what the literature highlighted. He was being, you know, obviously that's as the adrenaline is taking over in your body, where he noted specifically, and I'm quoting this, "I hope you're all Republicans." That's one of his jokes specifically as the doctors, you know, took him into the Washington University Hospital, the George Washington University Hospital in that particular city. Now, Reagan was then discharged 12 days later on, and he made a series of carefully staged public appearances that were designed to give the impression that he was recovering quickly. Though, in fact, he remained seriously weakened for months and that his workload was actually sharply curtailed following the assassination attempt. Now, if you don't know, ultimately, the strenuous activity that presidents go through, I mean, you just also have to look at the activities that our president herself obviously now is exposed to. I mean, you look at all the particular engagements that she has had between being inaugurated in 21 March up until the day, which is obviously 22 June, it has been up and down, and you can literally see the activities, you know, in terms of the particular scheduling and ultimately the particular engagements that take place and the kinds of dignitaries that are met and engaged with. So you understand the particular high-level aspect of the work and how this high-level aspect of the work technically also takes a toll on the person itself. And I'm not speaking as if to say, you know, this is a particular job that weakens someone. It's a particular job that if you are someone that loves your sleep a lot, just know that your sleep comes at a premium. That's the only particular downside. I mean, it's one of the first things that I heard from, what was the US president's name? Obama, where he said, the first thing he was asked, so what are you going to do after stepping down as U.S. president? He said it's the first time he'll be able to sleep peacefully. He'll be able to have his own particular sleep. So it's not an easy job out there if you're specifically the head of state of a country. So just so you guys know, it's not all unicorns and rainbows and, you know, fun and games. No. There's actually a lot of health-impacting activities that you've got to engage in. But we're not in a Namibian component. We're technically looking at a unique and a very weird historical occurrence that only takes place in the United States. Most part, because they've had so many particular attempts. It's not the first time a global leader obviously had been shot. You've had Shinzo Abe that was shot by a man. Shinzo, if you don't know who Shinzo Abe is, he was a former Japanese prime minister. He was busy campaigning at a political rally for his party. Once again, he was standing as a prime ministerial candidate for his party for the Japanese, for the Japanese elections. And he was at one of his particular rallies. And a man came from behind. Now, remember, dear listeners, this is a country that technically has very strict laws on gun possession. And it was found that this guy had improvised and created a particular improvised firearm that allowed him to approach Abe from behind and technically, you know, then obviously commit the act, which was shooting Abe in the back. That was obviously one of the particular unique things. I think it was 3 years back, 2021, when Abe was shot and then rushed to hospital. And it brought about a weird particular discussion in terms of what happens? Why are these particular global leaders attacked in their own countries by their own people? Now, remember, we started off with John Hinckley Jr. and Ronald Reagan's particular event, and we're still coming back to it. Because in August of 1981, 13,000 members of a National Union of Air Traffic Controllers, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, one of the few unions to endorse Reagan in the 1980 election, walked off their jobs, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. Now, as federal employees, the PATCO, members were forbidden by law to strike, and Reagan, on advice of the Transportation Secretary, Drew Lewis, refused to negotiate and gave them 48 hours to return to work. Now, most of the striking controllers ignored the ultimatum and were promptly fired. This is a known fact. It happened. The American air traffic controllers industry is still recovering from this firing. This, you know, yes, guys, if you don't know, they are still recovering. It took, what was the guy's name? John Oliver. On, you know, on his particular show, the Tonight with the John Oliver show, where he did this particular discussion, and he did speak about this same event in terms of Reagan, who refused to negotiate with these federal employees and their union, and he literally went on air as a president and said, we will break them. Obviously speaking the political rhetoric against fellow, you know, Americans, which is a bit weird, but I've seen it the same happen here in Namibia, so it's not weird in that scenario in terms of where fellow Namibian tries to victimize each other of, not victimize each other, but rather accuse each other of one or other particular, you know, major event, which we all have to discern whether or not it is actually that major. So, Reagan refused to negotiate with the union of these federal employees. People were fired back then. That particular industry is still struggling till the day. Do you know that they use floppy disks in the American air traffic controllers industry? Still till the day, 2025. That's how old their technology is. Yes, dear listeners, do you know when was the last time you saw a floppy disk? For any of you that have ever seen a floppy disk, those of you that are obviously Gen Z and Gen Alpha, you would have never seen a floppy disk. You don't even know what that thing is. They still use floppy disks. In air traffic control centers and zones of the US airspace. So, although the firings caused delays and reductions in air traffic until replacements were hired and trained, the general public generally reacted positively to Reagan's action, seeing it as a sign of decisiveness and conviction. Now, he later on went to write that it convinced people who might have thought otherwise that I meant what I said. That's Reagan's own words. Now, this obviously spoke to the so-called supply-side economic program that Ronald Reagan had propounded in his campaign. The supply side of things. Now, Reagan proposed massive tax cuts, 30% reductions in both individual and corporate income taxes over a three-year period, which he believed would stimulate the economy enough and eventually increase revenues from taxes as income levels grew. Now, at the same time, he proposed large increases in military expenditures, $1.5 trillion over a five-year period, and significant cuts in discretionary spending on social welfare programs, such as education, food stamps, low-income housing, school lunches for poor children, Medicaid, which is the major program of health insurance for the poor, and aid to families with dependent children, the AFDC. Now, in 1981, the U.S. Congress passed most of the U.S. president's budget proposals, though the tax cuts were scaled back slightly to 25%. The results of his economic programs, which became known as Reaganomics, were mixed. A severe recession occurred in 1982, pushed the nation's unemployment rate to nearly 11%, the highest it had been since the Great Depression. Now, you would think, wow, Dwight, 11% sounds like nothing. Well, if you know that back then in 1982, the American population was about almost 500 million people. 11%, 50 million people, is a lot. It's a lot of people that are unemployed, that would be unemployed. It's not 50 to 60% out of 3 million in Namibia. Let that sink in. So 50 to 60% out of 3 million in Namibia. Now, the bankruptcies and the farm foreclosures reached record levels. The country's trade deficit increased from $25 billion in 1980 to $111 billion in 1984. In addition, the huge increases in military spending combined with insufficient cuts in other programs produced massive budget deficits, the largest in the US's history. By the end of Reagan's second term, the deficits would contribute to a tripling of the national debt to more than $2.5 trillion. And in order to address the deficit problem, Reagan backed away from strict supply side theories to support a $98.3 billion tax increase in 1982. By early 1983, the economy had begun to recover, and by the end of that year, unemployment and inflation were significantly reduced. They remained relatively low in later years. But the economic growth continued through the remainder of Reagan's presidency, a period that his supporters would hail as the longest peacetime expansion in American history. Now, the critics, also that same scenario, highlighted that the tax cuts and the fruits of economic growth benefited mainly the wealth, and that the gap between the rich and the poor had grown wider. Now, this particular scenario, obviously, of what this base was based upon, because as I told you a little bit earlier, and at the top of the hour from 6 a.m., to 7, obviously, since you'll be in my company from 5 to 7, We'll be looking at all the U.S. presidents that were impacted through this particular activity known as, you know, assassinations that came through from regular citizens out there in the general public. The gentleman, John Hinckley Jr., is still alive. And he's now currently 70 years old. But he's most well known for the particular activity of what he committed back in 1981 when he attacked the US President Ronald Reagan outside that hotel that I just mentioned a little bit earlier. Now, his full name is John Warnock Hinckley, Jr., because obviously that means that his father would also be, would be John Warnock Hinckley Sr. The event that took place was literally 2 months after Reagan was inaugurated on 30 March 1981. Now, he used a revolver and Hinckley wounded Reagan, a police officer Thomas Delahunty, a Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, and the White House Press Secretary James Brady. Brady was left disabled and died 33 years later from his particular injuries. Now, Hinckley was reportedly seeking fame to impress an actress at that stage, and we've all heard of the actress, Jodie Foster, with whom he had a fixation after watching her in the Martin Scorsese 1976 movie Taxi Driver. Now, Hinckley was also found not guilty by reason of insanity and remained under institutional psychiatric care for over 30 years. So technically, his particular charge, you know, being institutionalized. The public outcry over the verdict led state legislatures, as well as also Congress, to narrow their respective insanity defenses. Because in 2016, a federal judge ruled that Hinckley could be released from psychiatric care as he was no longer considered a threat to himself or others, albeit with many particular conditions associated to his release. Now, after 2020, a ruling was issued that Hinckley may showcase his artwork, writings, and music publicly under his own name rather than anonymously as he had done in the past. And since then, he has maintained a YouTube channel for his music, obviously showing his particular sort of like, you know, being allowed back into the broader society in terms of interactions, and that his restrictions were unconditionally lifted in June of 2022. Now, as you can obviously see, the reasoning given, because that obviously was the reasoning that the police could extract from Hinckley when he was arrested, was why did you attack the US president? And Hinckley highlighted that he wanted to impress an actress. Now, it's not too far from actually what happened to John Lennon. If any of you know what happened to the famous British musician John Lennon, John Lennon was assassinated by a man in the US who was fixated with John Lennon. To say stalker would be, adding a different dimension onto it, because this was a guy that literally tried to look like John Lennon. There's a movie made also about this particular event in terms of, the what led to and what was the contributing factors to the individual that actually committed the act on Lennon. No, not Lennon the Russian, John Lennon the Englishman, the musician. The fixation back then, and this is a little bit of a leap, the fixation back then by ordinary people in society in the US, and this is in the 70s, where they were fixated with the global leaders, which included artists. John Lennon was a global artist. He achieved that notoriety through the Beatles. And obviously he then tried his own solo career and his much publicized wedding with his wife, Yoko Ono. And then obviously, you know, how that was sort of like an all-access, display to the whole Western world about their life and their early life to the, you know, to the birth of their first child. And then you could understand ultimately why you would get these particular, you know, stalk-ish behaviors in some cases. Now, the downside obviously is that, Hinckley Jr., that guy that attacked the US president, Ronald Reagan, it's not clear whether or not there was enough proof between anything of Ronald Reagan's policies and what motivated Hinckley. Because you have to ask that question. What motivated this man to attack a US president? Was it anything that this US president was doing? Because it's only 2 months into his presidency and he's being shot. It's only 2 months. The time frame, obviously, is that a year later, the court case obviously concludes in a partial win for Hinckley, being that he was institutionalized as opposed to being put in prison. But that the institutionalization was technically one of similar to a lengthy punishment period. Now, it then strikes a particular chord in terms of what he actually had to face in terms of his trial. Because the criminal charges that were brought against him, and the motive stands still, till the day. The motive stands there, an attempt to gain the attention of the actress Jodie Foster. The criminal charges that he faced back then were attempting to kill the US president, an assault on a federal officer, use of a firearm during the commission of a federal felony, assault with a dangerous weapon four times, assault with an intent to kill while being armed, assaulting a police officer with a deadly weapon, and carrying a pistol without the required license. The verdict, obviously, as I highlighted a little earlier, not guilty on all counts by reason of insanity. Penalty was institutionalization, and the victims were 1 killed, 3 injured, and 2 stalked. So, he has had a history, a criminal history before of this, prior, because some of his crimes span from the 1970s up to 1981. So, and this is born from my exposure, I wouldn't say forced exposure, but it has been exposure that I've unfortunately been a, you know, second-hand viewer through someone else that watches these particular contents, is that when the police tell you, and many of these documentaries that you find even on the internet, when the police tell you that they always look at criminal histories, has this person previously, you know, done something else, or are they escalating in their tendencies, or are they going somewhere else with this particular discussion? What are they trying to do? Where do they come from? And who are they? John Hinckley Jr., and it's stated here, he had been committing crimes since the 1970s. They say late 1970s, but we can technically just say probably it's what they know of, and not that they can say definitively, we believe it only started from the late 1970s in terms of this particular attitude, behavior, and the kinds of crimes that he was committing up until 1981 when he was caught. Now, you've got to ask yourself, dear listeners, when the police tell you, well, it's not like our police locally has, you know, spoken much about such subject matter as well at hand, because in many cases media just ask questions in terms of pretty straightforward stuff, pretty bland stuff. I mean, that's also where you get disappointed by our own local media, in terms of they don't ask a question that elevates or pushes the threshold of in access to information, in terms of asking, you know, do you know why this person committed this act? What was the motivation? Stuff like that. Most documentaries about police work or the events of crime around the world, most documentaries explain to you motivations. Why does crime occur? Motivations, motivations, and motivations. Now we've reached the top of the hour at 6 a.m. We will be stepping to a short musical break, and after it, we'll come back and we'll head into that list that I want to share with you in with much anticipation, because it is an insightful. Not the other inciting, you know, insightful, you know, it gives you insight into the subject matter. Because a lot of them are also very impactful. They are. I mean, especially that you'll hear of US presidents that you've never heard of before, and ultimately how it impacted them. But on that note, dear listeners, we'll be back right after this. And coming back there from the sounds of UB40 with the song Where Did I Go Wrong. Before that, you had a little bit of the sounds, or the very particular sort of like mesmerizing sounds of Paolo Nottini with his song that highlighted just a little bit of a nice, because I am obviously a fan favorite of Paolo Nottini with the song Children of the Stars. But it brings us to 10 past the the top of the hour at 6 a.m. Or the top, 10 past the hour of 6, not at the top of the hour. A little bit of a weird analogy there. But anyway, we're getting to this particular list of similar particular assassination attempts that obviously occurred on U.S. presidents in the U.S. context. In our discussion for this morning. Now, I just want to add on a little bit, something extra. Hinckley Jr., John Hinckley Jr., the gentleman that obviously made the attempt on the US President, Ronald Reagan's life in 1981, he'd actually been stalking Reagan a lot earlier. So, what are we talking about? So, Hinckley became obsessed with the actress Jodie Foster, like we identified a little bit earlier, because of her role that she played in the movie Taxi Driver. Now, if you don't know who Taxi Driver is, Taxi Driver is based upon the two main characters played by Robert De Niro, whose character is technically this mentally unstable taxi driver. I'm sorry if you're a cab driver out in Windhoek, but the character stalks a woman who was played by Sybil Shepherd in the movie, because the Robert De Niro's character becomes so fixated on this woman, and it leads to obviously a negative occurring. Now, Jodie Foster was not the lead actress; it was Sybil Shepherd. Foster's character was a secondary character in the overall story. However, the same particular fixation actually resonates with what Robert De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, that was the character's name, actually then realizes or tries to achieve something. Because Robert De Niro's character, obviously as he's stalking Sybil Shepherd's character, he can't, you know, sort of like attract her attention to him. And the character decides to plot to assassinate the US president. Now, you can obviously see where this influence comes from, because Bickle was partly based on the diaries of Arthur Bremer, who attempted to assassinate George Wallace. Arthur Bremer was an American convicted criminal who attempted to assassinate the US president, George Wallace, on 15 May 1972. Well, technically, George Wallace was a presidential candidate back then. So, technically, he didn't win. And this event took place in Laurel, Maryland. So, it's a similar particular event to, like, what happened to Trump last year. So, Hinckley developed an infatuation with this particular idea. This particular, 12-year-old character by Jodie Foster, played by Jodie Foster. And remember, the movie came out in 1976. Jodie Foster was playing a 12-year-old character. Yes, guys. Hinckley began to adopt the mannerisms and the dress code of Travis Bickle's character, and obviously, tried to mimic this particular character's approach. Foster went to Yale University after she obviously finished high school. And Hinckley then moved to New Haven, Connecticut. Now, I don't know how far Connecticut is from, or New Haven in Connecticut is from Yale University. Sounds like they're pretty close. And this is where he also began to stalk Foster. His parents, that's now Hinckley's parents, had given him some funds to attend a writing course at Yale, the same university, but he never used the money for that particular endeavor. And he actually used the money to support himself while sending Jodie Foster love letters and romantic poems and repeatedly calling and leaving her messages. Now, failing to develop any meaningful contact with Foster, Hinckley then fantasized about conducting an aircraft hijacking or killing himself in front of her to get her attention. This eventually led to his final idea. The idea that he settled on a scheme to impress her by assassinating the US president. Remember what I just told you. Travis Bickle, the character in the movie Taxi Driver, is based upon the author, Arthur Bremer. Oh no, not the author, but rather on the diaries of an attempt of, you know, someone that attempted to kill a presidential candidate in the US not too long ago, Arthur Bremer, who attempted to assassinate George Wallace. And his diaries obviously would have been used as some sort of evidence in the court case at that time. Because the movie's character is based upon this character. And this is what Hinckley also settles on, views himself in this particular scenario. Now I think, not I, he thought. Hinckley thought that by achieving a place in history, he would appeal to Foster as an equal. So Hinckley trailed Jimmy Carter, US President Jimmy Carter. This is before Reagan. From state to state during his campaign for his 1980 United States presidential election and got to within 20 feet is about what? 10 meters? Yeah, 20 feet is about 10 meters. Got within 10 meters of Jimmy Carter in Dayton, Ohio. That was at a political rally by Carter. On 9 October 1980, Hinckley was in Nashville, Tennessee on the same day Carter was visiting the city. Hinckley was arrested at Nashville International Airport while trying to board a plane to New York with handcuffs and 3 unloaded guns in his hand luggage. He had 3 guns on him. The airport police handed him over to the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department. Hinckley's guns and handcuffs were confiscated, and he was fined $50 plus court costs. He was released later the same day, you know, by the Nashville police. After Nashville, Hinckley then flew to Dallas in Texas. And on 13 October, he bought more guns from a Dallas pawn shop. They included 22 caliber ROM RG-14 revolver, the one that he used 5 months later to attempt to assassinate Reagan. $3,600 that his parents had sent him was now exhausted and he had to return home penniless, technically, without money. But he spent 4 months undergoing psychiatric treatment for depression, but his mental health did not improve. And in 1981, obviously, he began to target the newly elected president, Ronald Reagan. And for this purpose, he collected material on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It then gets us into our list, dear listeners, because the list itself, though it's not that long, but it is that prominent, because you at least have 4, 5 U.S. presidents that passed away, but primarily because of this presidential candidate, makes it 6. Attempted, you have at least 2, 3 actually, that were profound. Four, obviously, for the last one. I'll highlight all of these, guys. Don't worry. All of them, you know, speak of weird antics that obviously popped up in terms of this particular endeavor. Now, the subject matter in the U.S. context is known as the assassinations and assassination attempts on U.S. presidents and presidential candidates. Most of the plots, most of the events were successfully intercepted and foiled by the security apparatus, obviously, of the law enforcement in the US and the likes. Because in most cases, it was, you know, it was a scenario of how some of these particular potential perpetrators identified themselves. Now, once again, I point back to a sort of like a resource that I loosely rely on. I say loosely because I haven't read extensively into it, but I've observed it through documentaries. The police, and this is police from the US, police from the UK, police from Australia, even in South Africa, on these documentaries, these crime documentaries, they will tell you, in many cases, if it is someone that tries to hurt or attack a very prominent person, usually it's a politician or a sports star or a very famous celebrity, there's always been first, you know, earlier instances of trying to grab attention of the person, the victim, you know, trying to grab attention of the victim or the supposed victim in that stage, if, you know, anything serious had happened before. And many of the particular discussions that obviously span from this has been, you know, what other activities have taken place. Now, what I've just shared with you about John Inglee Jr. is that John Inglee Jr., since 1976, had been known to the police in the US. That flight, where it was, where he was caught with three pistols and handcuffs and then caught on the flight, that should have been the first red flag that the whole security apparatus in the US should have gone like, yo, what's going on here? What's this guy trying to do? Now, there actually have been four US presidents that have been killed throughout the American history. The most famous of them is obviously Abraham Lincoln's assassination in the theater. You have James Garfield, William McKinley, and John F. Kennedy. After the assassination of McKinley in 1901, the U.S. Secret Service took on the elite task of protecting past, present, and after 1968, potential future presidents and their families. Now that gets us into our particular discussion, our particular list. So we're starting off with the assassinations. Abraham Lincoln, 14 April 1865. Location was Washington, D.C. The perpetrator, you would not never, in a Namibian context, you would never have heard of him, but for those of you whose, you know, general knowledge is more global, as well as also grounded locally, the perpetrator, known to history, is John Wilkes Booth. They've made multiple movies about this particular event. The weapon that was used was a pistol. Now, Lincoln, also known as the Great Emancipator, because you've got to know why he was known as the Great Emancipator, is because of he brought forward specifically, or he tried to extend voting rights to the former slave population of the United States. Which was also one of the particular reasons as to what led to the U.S. Civil War. Now, Lincoln served as the 16th president of the U.S. between 1861 to 1865, and during his presidency, the American Civil War was fought, during which he freed and enslaved people in Confederate territories. Now, the 13th Amendment would ultimately end slavery in the United States, but Lincoln would not live to see it being ratified. Before the Civil War, John Wilkes Booth had been a celebrated actor and he was part of an acting troupe. How it worked back then is that actors would travel across the country and then they would perform at various, you know, various sites and cities, you know, and obviously try to make money from it. And they had developed this close bond with their associates, which were the other actors and the other particular sort of like, you know, members of their troupe. And, you know, it usually was something that was known back then as these particular traveling companies. Now, when the war broke out, Booth became a Confederate sympathizer who hated the idea of abolition and hated Lincoln for his role in emancipating enslaved people. Now, initially, Booth and a group of co-conspirators planned to kidnap Lincoln, but then he escalated the plans to murder the president. So it was Booth's idea. But actually, it included not just Lincoln, it included Lincoln's vice president, Andrew Johnson, and Secretary of State at the time, William Seward. Now, Booth learned that Lincoln would be at the Ford's Theater watching Our American Cousin and set his plan into motion. On 14 April of 1865, Booth sneaked into the U.S. president's box. It's a little, you know, a little booth in the theater, carrying with him a .44 caliber Derringer, which was easily hidden, and a dagger, and Booth fired his pistol, shooting Lincoln in the head. He then jumped from the box onto the stage, breaking his leg as a result, and exclaimed either "Sic semper tyrannos," which says thus always to tyrants, the state motto of Virginia, or "The South is avenged." Now, that, according, was to various reports from the audience before fleeing into the night. Lincoln died on 15 April. The next day, Booth was tracked down to a barn about 12 days after the assassination, and he wouldn't surrender even as the barn was set on fire. And the Union soldier, Thomas Boston Corbett, shot Booth in the neck, and he died a few hours later on. Another U.S. president that unfortunately also met a similar fate as Lincoln was James A. Garfield. On 2 July 1881, the location was also in Washington, D.C., and the perpetrator was Charles Gitto. The weapon also used was a pistol as well. Now, after serving as a major general in the Union Army during the Civil War and completing 9 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, James Garfield was elected as the U.S. president, as the 20th U.S. president in 1880. Now, although his presidency only lasted 200 days, the second shortest in history, Garfield implemented post office reforms, strengthened federal authority over the New York Customs House, and advocated for civil rights for black Americans. Now, he clashed with Republican power brokers by refusing to make patronage cabinet appointments. On 2 July 1881, 4 months into the presidency, Garfield was traveling to New England, it's a state in the U.S., with his family for a vacation. During that time, he planned to relax and deliver a speech at his alma mater, which was Williams College in Massachusetts. Now, as the president walked into the Baltimore and Potomac Railroad Station in Washington, D.C., Charles Gitto shot him in the back with a .44 British Bulldog pistol. Now, the doctors rushed Garfield's aid, but caused infection by treating him with unsterilized hands. And though the bullet wound was survivable, Garfield's condition slowly worsened and he died 80 days later on 19 September 1881. During his final months, Americans anxiously awaited medical updates, then mourned the promising leader they had barely known, and Garfield's vice president, Chester Arthur, assumed the presidency. Now, Gitto was a mentally unstable, aspiring politician who had believed that Garfield's death could help him achieve his desired patronage job, surrendered to the police. Now, it's the second time that we obviously hear the particular term patronage job. But I wouldn't put it past the thinking that I have at the start of my, you know, particular head, the start of my particular mind. It literally is what I thought it was. So a patronage job, dear listeners, was, we used to call it a very negative name here, Jobs for Comrades, in the media discussion. It's literally the thing. It's jobs for supporters. So patronage jobs, the reason as to why Garfield was assassinated was because Gitto wanted a patronage job. And remember what I highlighted to you a little bit earlier. Garfield annoyed the Republican Party, power brokers, who wanted to give jobs to party supporters. Let me say that again. The US president went against the interests of political party power brokers who wanted to reward supporters with jobs. So the Americans actually know about corruption a lot longer than what we Africans actually know about. Man, man, man. But anyway. So, Gitto thought that he could get a patronage job. And obviously he was trying to be an aspiring politician as well. Now, Gitto had actually stalked Garfield for weeks and considered the president's death an act of God. And the assassin actually pleaded insanity but failed to convince the jury and was executed by hanging on 30 June 1882. We get into another particular US president that fell victim to the same fate. William McKinley. You might never have heard of this man. Don't worry, I also almost, I mean, I'm not that fixated on American presidential history, but it is sometimes interesting to understand the lesser known characters from the US presidency. William McKinley died on 6 September 1901. Location was Buffalo. Perpetrator was a gentleman by the name of Leon Scholgos. Yeah, Scholgos. Weapon was also a pistol. Now, McKinley was the 25th president of the U.S. and the third to be assassinated. Now, he served from 4 March 1897 to the day he died, 14 September 1901. So that was already like 6 years, a good 5 years in office. Now, during his first term, McKinley notably led the U.S. to victory in the Spanish-American War, which was technically fought over Cuba, but if I tell you why they fought the Spanish over for Cuba, specifically that it was to get American farmers to farm in Cuba, which was the exact thing that Che Guevara and Fidel Castro didn't like when they came into the political awareness arena. By realizing, but the economic system was negatively impacting the everyday Cuban. Now, the second scenario of his term was also the increased protective tariffs that were used to support domestic industries. Now, McKinley defeated the populist politician William Jennings Bryan for the second time to win a re-election. So the same two guys competed for the same presidency twice in a row. Months after his second inauguration in March 1901, McKinley attended the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo. Now the city welcomed McKinley and his party with a 9-ton elephant, a 389-foot, which is 119-meter electric tower, fireworks, and a crowd of more than 100,000 people. But on the second day of his visit, the celebratory cheers quickly became horrified gasps, because a gentleman that was identified as an anarchist and a former steel worker, Leon Scholgos, waited in line to shake hands with McGinley. At about 4:07 in the afternoon, with his pistol concealed in a handkerchief, Czolgosz shot McKinley twice, hitting him in the chest and in the abdomen. Enraged onlookers began attacking the assailant, and McKinley was rushed to the Exposition's hospital, where he underwent emergency surgery. Now, though the president was expected to recover, gangrene, which is the death of tissue, yeah, that's as your tissue is about is dying on you, developed on the sides of his stomach, and he died of pancreatic necrosis 8 days afterwards, after the shooting, with his wife also, you know, observing this particular passing. Now, Czolgosz confessed to the murder, proclaiming that he had done his duty and expressed no remorse. On 29 October 1901 in that year, Czolgosz was executed by electric chair at the New York Auburn prison. Now, McKinley's assassination was met with outpouring of grief, and his vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, assumed office. Now, you've got John F. Kennedy up next, which is obviously the fourth of these particular presidents. John F. Kennedy, on 22 November 1963, unfortunately was shot and killed in Dallas, Texas, by the perpetrator, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the weapon that was used was a bolt-action rifle. So in the autumn of 1963, the popular incumbent president John F. Kennedy was preparing for his re-election campaign and attempting to unify the Democratic Party by giving speeches in several states. Now, as Texas was a key battleground state, Kennedy and his wife, Jacqueline Kennedy, embarked on a two-day, five-city tour of the state. Now, when he arrived in Dallas, the fourth city on the itinerary, the couple greeted a crowd of supporters and sat in the back seat of a custom open convertible to ride to the Trademark, which was the venue for his speech later on in that day. But the Texas Democratic governor, John Connally, and his wife, Nellie, sat in the front of the car. That was obviously the car that he died in. Now, about 12:30 midday, this is now as all the passengers and the onlookers along the side of the street obviously heard and saw the particular action of what happened to the U.S. president, the incumbent. Bullets, multiple, struck the president's neck and his head, and he slumped over towards his wife. Now, the car sped to the Parkland Memorial Hospital, where Kennedy was pronounced dead at 1 p.m. that afternoon, literally 30 minutes afterwards. And the governor, Connally, had suffered a gunshot wound as well, but he survived. Now, the brutality of the assassination was caught on film by Abraham Zapruder, who was a Dallas resident who had left work to see the president's motorcade. Now, a shocked and a grieving nation at that stage, obviously, had to process the loss of a young, he was 46 at that stage, president, even as concerns about continuity of government started, you know, becoming more prominent. At 2:38 p.m., Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon B. Johnson, who had been traveling with Kennedy and had ridden in a separate car in the motorcade, grimly took the oath of office aboard Air Force One. Next to him stood a dazed and blood-spattered Jacqueline Kennedy. The jet carrying the slain president's body and the new president then headed back to Washington, D.C. Shortly after the assassination, police arrested Lee Harvey Oswald. He was labeled as a Marxist former U.S. Marine, but not before the suspect killed an officer, J.D. Tippit. 2 days later on, while police were moving Oswald from police headquarters to the county jail, a local nightclub owner, Jack Ruby, shot him at close range, killing him on live television. Now, while the FBI and the Warren Commission, the independent group assigned by Johnson to investigate the assassination, ruled that Oswald had acted alone, conspiracy theories, including those involving the Soviet and Cuban governments, still continue until this day. Now, I'll end there for like a 2 minute descriptor that I've got to add on, because there's this podcast that I watched at the start of this year who interviewed a guy who was a former mafia mobster, Italian mafia mobster, who now turned into this researcher writing books about the mafia and the mafia's particular roots in the United States. And if you guys can remember, that is if you watched it and if you paid attention to it, the same U.S. President, Donald Trump, announced at the start of his presidency, at the start of this year, that he would declassify the John F. Kennedy files and the Martin Luther King files. There's also another set of files that he would declassify. There was another one. Now, apparently, the files were hidden. The files also had potentially, you know, the identities of people that might still be alive. And that the files probably were sort of like one of the particular sort of like sales gimmicks that Trump used to sort of like stop the conspiracy theories from continuing wild, like wildfire in the US. Well, obviously it stopped the conspiracy theories to an extent with the recent antics that obviously have taken place up until today. This particular podcaster, because I don't follow him, I mean, it's pretty difficult to lay a finger on the kinds of conversation being that without showing, you know, documentary evidence of events, you know, it's pretty difficult. But this particular mobster highlighted the involvement of the nightclub owner, Jack Ruby, that killed Lee Harvey Oswald, in that it was definite proof of organized crime's involvement in the assassination of a head of state in the US. Which is a leap. It is a leap. It's not an improbable leap. It's not an impossible leap. But it is a leap. Because everyone knows that everything just stopped there. Even after the commission. And even after the FBI's investigation, because that ultimately would mean that the FBI gathered more data and more information. But the conspiracy theories still persist, even till today. Now, presidential candidates included John F. Kennedy's own brother, Robert F. Kennedy, his older brother, actually. No, his younger brother. Robert was the younger brother of John F. Kennedy. Then you had the attempted assassinations that also took place, but let me stop on just that single event of Robert F. Kennedy, because Robert F. Kennedy passed away on 5 June 1968 in Los Angeles by a gentleman by the name of Siran Siran, who also shot him, because it's the most common particular method. Now, this is 5 years after his older brother had passed away, because it had been 4 years since Robert F. Kennedy's older brother, John F. Kennedy, was slain in Dallas. Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed just 2 months before, Robert's death, while Martin Luther King was inciting riots across the country that were already embroiled in the Vietnam War. So Robert Kennedy was a presidential candidate whose supporters had hoped could ease all the turmoil that obviously took place. While celebrating his victory in the California Democratic presidential primary with a speech at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, Kennedy was shot in the head by Siran Siran, who was a Christian Palestinian. Now, Kennedy died the next day, but 5 others were wounded in the attack, but all had survived. Siran explained why he committed the act of killing Kennedy because of the candidate's support of Israel, or for Israel, and Siran was given the death penalty, but his sentence was later commuted to life in prison. Now, controversy still permeates the investigation into the younger Kennedy's murder. Some people, including the son of Robert F. Kennedy, And the 2024 presidential candidate, Robert, whose name is also Robert F. Kennedy because he's junior, contends that there was a second gunman as well, because it's also one of the conspiracies cited to his uncle's death, John F. Kennedy. Remember that I mentioned that there were two bullets, two shots. Now, it's a bit difficult to send off two shots by the same rifle, a bolt-action rifle, in close time frames. But yeah, don't worry, guys. There are ballistics experts out there that will explain all those particular scenarios. But yeah, those are still part of the conspiracies that still persist till this day. On the attempted side of things, you had Andrew Jackson. 30 January 1885, Washington, D.C. The perpetrator was a Richard Lawrence who tried to assassinate Andrew Jackson, one of the, you know, earliest presidents of the U.S. Now, Jackson, who was the 7th U.S. president, and considered the father of the modern presidency, despite once saying that his talents wouldn't suit the Oval Office. So by 1835, Jackson, a former soldier, was 67 years old in his second term and used a cane to walk. Now Jackson visited the U.S. Capitol on a cold and wet winter morning, while Richard Lawrence, an unemployed house painter, lay in wait behind a column of the Capitol Rotunda. Now Lawrence pulled a pistol on the president and fired, but only a plume of smoke and no bullet actually emerged. Jackson attacked the would-be assassin with his cane, and Lawrence once again misfired another pistol before being tackled to the ground by other bystanders. But Jackson was unarmed in what would be the first documented indirect attack on a U.S. president. At his trial, Lawrence explained, who was born in England but lived in Washington, revealed that he believed himself to be a rightful heir to the British throne. And in his mind, King Andrew, as Jackson was called by his political rivals, was all that stood in the way of his ascension. And Lawrence was declared insane and died in an asylum in 1861. The next particular act was that on Theodore Roosevelt. Remember the guy that was vice president and had to take over after a sitting president that was obviously assassinated as well. So the same fate almost awaited Theodore Roosevelt. On 14 October 1912, remember the guy that Roosevelt took over from was president. He was already president for like 5 years, but by 1901 he was into his second term. So this event to Theodore Roosevelt happened on 14 October 1912 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, United States. And the perpetrator was a known man named by the name of John Schrank. He also used a pistol. You know, the pistols are the pretty obvious ones. Now, Roosevelt became America's 26th president after William McKinley's assassination and served from 1901 to 1909. Now, he was the first president to survive a gunshot wound and the only president until Donald Trump to survive an assassination attempt while campaigning for a non-consecutive re-election. Roosevelt stepped away from the Oval Office after effectively 2 terms, but became disenchanted with his chosen successor, William Howard Taft, and decided to run for a 3rd term. Now, remember this thing of 2 terms, the 2 presidential terms in the U.S. actually came about after, was it Franklin D. Roosevelt, the son of Theodore, or was it because of Theodore? One of the 2 Roosevelts was so successful in re-elections that they literally brought in this particular amendment into the U.S. Constitution that said only a U.S. president can only have 2 terms. Which is the same particular thing that Donald Trump is now trying to reverse. He's trying to reverse that constitutional amendment. So, when Taft secured the Republican nomination, Roosevelt left his former party to form the Progressive, or Bull Moose, Party. Now, on the campaign trail, as Roosevelt was heading from his hotel to an evening speaking event in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, John Schrank, a German-American tavern owner, shot him in the chest. Now, the contents of Roosevelt's pockets, his paper speech, and his eyeglass case saved his life. And he insisted on addressing the crowd before letting doctors address the bleeding wound in his chest. Now, to open his 90-minute speech, Roosevelt proclaimed, "I don't know whether you fully understand that I have just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose." Quote, unquote. End of quote, actually. So Schenck, who acted alone, claimed to have had visions of the late McKinley calling for Roosevelt's death, and physicians declared him insane and sent him to Wisconsin's Central State Hospital for the criminally insane, where he died in 1943. Oh my goodness. The son was also attacked. Franklin D. Roosevelt, 15 February 1933 in Miami, and the perpetrator was an American-Italian, Giuseppe, or an Italian-American, Giuseppe Zangara, and he also used a pistol. Franklin Delano Roosevelt served as the 32nd president of the U.S. He was best known for his New Deal and for having the longest run as president, serving from 1933 to 1945. But his first inauguration, or before his first inauguration, Roosevelt was giving a speech at Bayfront Park in Miami when an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara worked his way through the crowd and opened fire at the president-elect. Now Zangara, who was a World War I veteran who suffered from chronic pain, grew to have a hatred for capitalists and the ruling class and sought to make an example out of Roosevelt. Now as he fired the first shot, Lillian Cross, a spectator sitting next to Zangara during the speech, immediately sprang up and wrestled him for his gun as he continued firing. Roosevelt wasn't injured, but the next shots injured five people. One fatally wounded Anton Cermak, the mayor of Chicago at the time. Several attendees assisted Cross and descended on Zangara to stop his attack. The mob would have beaten him to death if Roosevelt hadn't admonished them to leave Zangara's fate to the judicial system. Now, acting swiftly, the court sentenced Zangara to 80 years in prison for attempted murder. And when Cermak died from his wounds, Zangara was retried for murder and sentenced to death. He died by the electric chair on 20 March 1933. Then there was Harry Truman's particular attempt. Now, this was on the 1st of November 1950. Harry S. Truman, who also became a U.S. president. This was in Washington, D.C., and the perpetrators were two, Oscar Colazzo and Gresilio Torresola. And they both used pistols. Now, Truman became the 33rd president after Franklin D. Roosevelt's death after a stroke and served from 12 April 1945 to 20 January 1953. He led the U.S. through the final stages of World War II and the early stages of the Cold War. His major presidential actions included ordering the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, implementing the Marshall Plan, and coordinating the Berlin airlift involving the U.S., in the Korean War and coordinating social welfare programs. Now, during Truman's second term, while the White House underwent renovations, the first family stayed at the nearby Blair House. On the afternoon of 1 November 1950, Truman was upstairs taking a nap when gunfire rang out. Two Puerto Rican nationalists, Oscar Colazzo and Gresilio Torresola, had opened fire at the residence's front door with hopes of assassinating the president to bring attention to their cause. The Secret Service detail successfully stopped the attack. Leslie Kofeld, the Secret Service officer stationed in the guard booth outside the Blair House, was mortally wounded in the gunfight, but managed to kill Torresola. He's the only agent in history to die protecting a president. Truman went about his normal activities after the attempt on his life, but expressed extreme grief over Kofeld's death and the injuries sustained by the other two guards while stopping the attack. When Colazzo received the death penalty, Truman reduced his sentence to life in prison. In 1979, almost 30 years later on, the U.S. President Jimmy Carter commuted Colazzo's sentence and the would-be assassin lived out his final years in Puerto Rico. There was a presidential candidate as well, George Wallace. 15 May 1972, location was Laurel, Maryland in the United States, and the perpetrator, Arthur Bremer, that we mentioned a little bit earlier in conjunction with the discussion on Ronald Reagan's attempted assassination. Well, not attempt, because well, yes, attempt. George C. Wallace was the governor of Alabama and a candidate for the Democratic Party during the 1972 presidential election. He was known for his staunch segregationist views with Martin Luther King Jr., calling him the most dangerous racist in the United States. Now, on 15 May 1972, Wallace gave a campaign speech at the Laurel Shopping Center, and as the candidate descended from the podium to shake hands with supporters, a 21-year-old Arthur Bremer shot Wallace 5 times. Now, Bremer was a busboy. Now, if you don't know what a busboy is, a busboy is usually like these attendants. They're not like waiters, but they are people that actually help you with, you know, certain particular activities at certain particular sites. So he was a busboy at an athletic club from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he was born to working-class parents. Now, in his book, An Assassin's Diary, published in 1973, he recounted how he made plans to gain fame by assassinating either President Richard Nixon or Wallace. He initially had planned to attack Nixon during a mid-April visit to Ottawa, but tight security thwarted him. He then set his sights on Wallace. Now, Wallace survived his injuries, but was paralyzed from the waist downwards. He ended his presidential ambitions and spent the rest of his life seeking forgiveness from the black community in the U.S., for his active role in upholding segregation in the South. Now, as a born-again Christian, Wallace renounced his segregationist ways, was elected as governor of Alabama in 1989 with the support from 90% of his voters, and appointed more than 160 African-Americans to state positions. He later on died on 13 September 1998. But Bremer was sentenced to 53 years in prison and served 35 years before he was released on parole in 2007. His book served as an inspiration for the screenplay of the film Taxi Driver, and Bremer currently resides in Cumberland, Maryland, still in the U.S. till this day. That, unfortunately, dear listeners, does bring us up to the end of our discussion for this morning in terms of the discussion itself, but the tendency seems to be very high. I mean, even based upon the event that happened on this day, or actually yesterday, pertaining towards one of these particular events of attempts on the life of a U.S. president, specifically that being the actions of John Hinckley Jr., specifically as he tried to take the life of a sitting U.S. president, Ronald Reagan, in that regard. Now, we're stepping into a short musical break, and after the musical break, it will technically lead us up to the end of this morning's engagement, but before we do that, we take a short ad break.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Now, coming back from the quick break right there, dear listeners, and ultimately the scenario of the events, obviously, that we highlighted just now are specific scenarios of usually when you look into the particular details of the parties, specifically those that are perpetrators or who committed a specific crime or an event. The correlation is pretty clear in terms of that there was a specific need, a specific demand that they felt should have been handed to them. One of them was only purely economic. One. A couple were political, and a couple were also trying to claim insanity as a defense, except for John Hinckley Jr.'s regard. But as promised, we quickly step into our musical break and we come back right after that, heading into what would be the end of this morning's program here on your number one talk radio station. and we listen to a little bit more of Paolo Nutini.
Need lightning fast internet? Paratus has you covered. The network Namibia relies on. Whether for business or pleasure, Paratus' cutting edge technology ensures both reliable and speedy internet connectivity.